Welcome back, everybody, to the X-Cast, X-Files, Podwatch. This is episode 76 of our series covering the entire run of the X-Files. Today, we're having a look at Signs and Wonders and Sane Unsight. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm joined again by Chris Knowles. Hey there, Chris.
Carl, good to be here.
Yeah, good to talk to you again as well. We're only doing a handful of these seventh season episodes together, so I just thought I'd ask you quickly, like, your general thoughts and feelings about the seventh season.
Well, it's really interesting. When the season aired, I was really tuned into it on a very strange level, and I can't quite explain it. I mean, it really seemed to resonate with me, like, personally, and it was weird. It was like things that were happening in my life would, like, be reflected in the show. And so, you know, at one point, I was really quite attached to the season. As time went on, you know, it's a very strange season. The tone is all over the place. They just can't seem to decide what kind of show they want to do. Yeah. And I think that hurts the season overall. It just has no identity. It has no, you know, it has no overall message or meaning to it. It's just kind of they're clearing out the drawers. Maybe there was a certain feeling behind the scenes that this was going to be the last season, you know, particularly with the fallout from the lawsuit and whatnot. But I don't know. It's just at the time it really struck me, like it was particularly Sign and Zeit and Closure were just like I'd never seen, you know, anything that affected me the way that those two episodes did. But with the passage of time, you just sort of see that there's a great deal of confusion in the making of this season. I don't think they really, anybody was on the same page. They were just trying to get the episodes done.
Okay, let's have a look at these two specifically. So the first one is Signs and Wonders. It's the ninth episode of the season. It was broadcast for the first time in January of 2000. It was written by Jeffrey Bell and directed by Kim Manners. And this is the episode which sees Mulder and Scully looking into the death of a man killed by poisonous snakes, and their investigation leads them to a fundamentalist group called the Church of God with Signs and Wonders. This is an episode you don't really hear people talk about much, or at least I don't, but it's always one that I've quite liked. What do you make of it?
I like it quite a bit in and of itself. It's a good, dark, season two kind of supernatural horror story. And the performance, I mean, Michael Childers, who plays Enoch O'Connor, is just absolutely amazing. And, you know, we have this interesting thing that I don't think a lot of people have really paid attention to, that throughout the LAX files, you have all these people from Millennium showing up. Mm. And in this episode, it's Tracy Middendorf, who was in the great Darwin's Eye episode. The only thing that I would really kind of find fault in is that it doesn't seem to me that David and Jillian were particularly tuned into this story. They seem to sort of just sleepwalk their way through it. They just don't seem engaged with the narrative.
I was going to ask you about that, because my memory of the series at this time certainly is that David Duchovny was getting a lot of criticism online for people who were saying he was phoning in his performances. I was just wondering how valid you think that was. Obviously, by the sounds of it, you do as regards this episode.
Yeah, I think this some truth to that, but you have to understand how just exhausting and exhausted these guys were. I mean, just all of these people, it's particularly David and Jillian, who really spent more time on camera than most series leads actually do in a show like this. So, I mean, I think it is a valid criticism, but I also, you know, understand that it just, like, it was enough already.
Anyway, earlier you mentioned the performance of, was it Michael Childers? Is that his name?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's a very, like, dynamic performance, and what this episode does really well, I think, is it keeps him and his church as, you know, quite unsympathetic, but at the same time, you can understand why people would be kind of swept up in what they're saying, you know, and Mulder and Scully have, you know, their typical kind of slightly didactic conversations where they talk about, Mulder says something about someone offering you all the answers can be a powerful thing. And I don't know, I just felt they handled that side of things well.
Well, I think Michael Childers' performance really has a lot to do with that. He's the son of a Pentecostal preacher. So, you know, he wasn't, he was just playing out, you know, a drama that he was very familiar with from his childhood. You know, I just want to make a point about you know, the dialectic of this episode. And that's that there's one line where Scully makes about, you know, some dismissive crack about people believing in flying saucers. And it's just like, really? I mean, she just spent like three episodes and, you know, researching, an alien craft off the coast of Africa. And she's making cracks about flying saucers now. Yeah. And it's just like somebody was asleep at the switch. You know, that line should have just been like, come on, this is ridiculous.
I think you were saying to me in one of the other episodes that, you know, Gillian Anderson was at this time, kind of this around this time, she was sort of saying, you know, how is this still credible? You know, that Scully's still kind of like putting up this resistance, you know. One aspect of this episode that I really like, I think it's well put together, is like the juxtaposition of the two sermons, you know, when you go from this very like vital, hot and heavy sermon to a much more buttoned down, kind of boring one. You know, I think it's just a very economical storytelling. You know, could have easily been three scenes that kind of explain that to us, but I think it gets the message across really well. And I don't know, I just think Kim Manners did a good job here. You know, some effective set pieces and some good scares. And this is the kind of thing I'd imagine, from what I've read about Manners, the kind of thing he like reveled in doing.
Yeah, well, he was a horror guy and he really enjoyed being able to dive into that genre. And you know, one of his favorite episodes was Home. And you know, he started off with Die Hand, Die Verletz. That was his initial, you know, that was his baptism of fire on the X-Files. So I think that, yeah, he's really in his element. And the only thing that really kind of bothers me, and it bothers me about the LAX phase as a whole, is that everything really looks like California. You know, this might not affect a lot of people from outside the United States, but, you know, they're going to all these different, you know, municipalities and locations, and everything really just kind of looks like Southern California. And it just always just distanced me from the narrative. You know, Vancouver had this magical power to, you know, anybody who's familiar with Vancouver knows it's Vancouver, but it had like this, almost like this magical energy, this ability to imitate other places that really have nothing to do with it. You know, either way, you believed it. But, you know, with the LAX files, I'm not quite sure I really buy that they're, you know, in Tennessee or whatever.
Yeah. I sort of prefer, like, I think they get towards a bit of a better aesthetic for the series in the seventh season than the sixth.
Yeah, oh, the lighting is much better.
Yeah.
They really nailed it. See, that's another thing that really struck me about the seventh season, is that the lighting is just fantastic. And, you know, Rob Bowman was really involved in designing the new look for the show. And I think it just took them a long time to figure out how to get around this blaring sun of Southern California. And, you know, they did have some luck later on in the season when they were filming. You know, it was like this huge deluge, this rainy season that hit Los Angeles. So episodes like Anna Me, you know, you had that kind of Vancouver-esque look. But yeah, the lighting, the tricks that they use to get around that blaring direct sunlight really give a lot of these episodes maybe a little bit more magical feeling than they would have normally had.
I've always been fascinated by, you know, like in the eighth season, I don't think they replicate it exactly, but they get back to a more back to basics feel. And you can sort of see like an alternative path where they'd have tried to do that in season six, where they wanted to pretend that nothing had changed, you know, but instead like they really like lean into it in season six, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting you should say that, because there is an episode, which isn't a very good episode at all, but it's an eighth season salvage. And it's really not very good, but it's just amazing how it really looks like a Vancouver episode, the texture and the lighting. So again, you know, back to this episode, I mean, there are a lot of very good aspects to this episode. I mean, it's great performances. It's, you know, it's an interesting twist. It's an interesting concept, but there are, you know, just like these LA era setbacks, you know, the fact that the cast is exhausted. David and Jillian are really not getting along very well at all at this point in time. And, you know, you've got Southern California, which is always going to look like Southern California.
Was there anything else you wanted to bring up here, Chris? I mean, maybe just a quick word on Jeffrey Bell. I don't know, credited with five episodes, and he sort of alternated between like Whimsy, you know, the Rain King, the Goldberg variation, And then this is probably the best of his standalones, I guess. He also did Alpha, I think, was one of his, and there's another one in the eighth season.
Yeah, he wrote Salvage.
Yeah, oh, it was Salvage, that's right, yeah.
Really not crazy about his work on the X-Files as a whole. Mm. I think he was part of like this circle with people like David Amman, who are sort of under Chris's wing. You know, you had people who worked with John Scheibman and Vince and Frank, but I think you also had sort of another crew that was more under Chris's aegis, and that he would tend to rewrite their stuff. You know, so there's a lot of stuff in this episode in Signs and Wonders that really feels very Chris Carter. You know, you sort of hear his voice a lot in this. And I think that it might have been a much different story initially, given Jeffrey Bell's, you know, he's more whimsical, he's more humorous. I think it might have been a more humorous story that was in the rewriting process became a lot darker.
So, Sein und Zeit is the 10th episode of the season. February 2000 is when it was broadcast, and it was written by series creator Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz, and directed by Michael Watkins. And, of course, this is the first part of a two-parter that will reveal, ultimately, Samantha Mulder's fate. This episode primarily concerns the disappearance of a young girl, Amber Lynn LaPierre. Okay, now this is an episode, or this two-parter, anyway, is an episode you hear talked about. My impression is that it remains divisive. I don't fully understand some of the vitriol directed at these two episodes. This feels, I don't know, like a real breath of fresh air to me at this point of the season. I think it's fantastic.
Oh, I think it's a classic. I think this two-parter is just a dead bang classic. I think it's probably some of the best work they ever did. You know, certainly some of Chris Carter's best writing. I think that in a lot of ways, Sein und Zeit is more effective than Closure. Even, you know, Closure sort of wraps things up, and you have that astonishing performance by Anthony Heald as Harold Pill, which is just, I think it's the best guest starring acting performance in the series history. But this episode, I think, is just phenomenal. It has just a pervasive mood, like it's just a pervasive feeling of dread that really, I think it's even more than, say, classic season two standalone horror. There's something just really disturbing about this episode. There's something that really gets under your skin, almost like you're steaming towards a freight train and, you know, you can't get out of the way. There's a feeling that these characters are all having to deal with just existential terror and horror in their lives. The great thing about the walk-in motif, which is you know, interesting because you have Mark Ralston in the character as Bud LaPierre, and he's also, you know, from Red Museum. So really what we have here is you have like this motif of the walk-ins, and my feeling, my very, very strong feeling, particularly in this episode, is that this is entirely a fantasy. This is people who can't face, you know, the existential terror of loss and horrible things that happen to their children, that it's almost like a compensatory fantasy. And I think that you can play it either way. You know, you could see it either as that, or you could see it as a supernatural intervention. Either way, it's terrifying. It's unsettling. And, you know, we talked about, whether David was fully engaged. I think he's just absolutely astonishing here. His performance is, you know, one of his series best. Duchovny could really pinpoint these very strange liminal emotional states that most actors can't even necessarily perceive, and he could perceive them and play them just to the note.
Yeah, I also think it's one of his best. I was going to say that, you know, whenever an episode in a similar-ish vein comes up, or, you know, with a similar-ish or similarities in the narrative. So I'm thinking of Oubliette or Paper Hearts, and this one, you can't fault him.
And let's be clear. I mean, the emotions that he's tapping into are not actorly emotions. They're very subtle. They're almost literary emotions, I think.
I was going to touch on the walk-in. I mean, you've mentioned the walk-ins. It seems to me that there are people who just can't get past the way that concept is described.
Let's be straight. I mean, let's really be clear about why people don't like this episode. Everybody wanted, or the people who don't like this episode, what they really wanted is they wanted a spaceship to land in the parking lot of the FBI, you know, Samantha Mulder to come out and everyone to hug and everything's, you know, happily ever after. I mean, they wanted happily ever after. Yeah. I think it's very clear from very early on that Samantha, you know, was always dead. I think that episodes like Oubliée and even to a certain extent Irresistible, you know, you really get the sense that this whole mythology is really about Mulder trying to deal with what he knows is the loss of his sister. I mean, this guy's an FBI profiler. He's a, you know, top agent, top of his class, on and on and on. I mean, he has to realize that, you know, she's gone. She's dead. And people just didn't want it to be like so ordinary and mundane like that. You know, that's what, you know, this whole idea of the walk-ins. I mean, what people don't understand where the walk-ins come from. Walk-ins are alien spirits, you know, in sort of UFO lore and things like that. There's a woman named Ruth Montgomery who wrote a book about this. You know, they're these alien spirits who come in and take over human bodies and on and on and on. So, I mean, they're really going deep into the, you know, the paranormal, you know, toy chest here. So I think it was just brilliant because she was always there. I mean, David Duchovny sort of makes a stray comment in that Inside the X-Files, that fifth season documentary about, you know, how she is actually dead. I mean, he just sort of alludes to it. But I think she was always dead. I think the whole idea of this mythology and the arc of Samantha is like he just can't face it. He can't deal with it. He has to go around looking for reasons to not believe that his worst fears have come true.
I've seen a comment from one of the producers. I think it was Paul Rabwin. And he said that he was glad that they dealt with the Samantha storyline here because he felt that it had become kind of like a millstone around the neck of the series. Do you think it was sort of played out for longer than it should have been? Or do you think it should have been focused on more, maybe?
They hadn't really even dealt with Samantha since Redux 2. So, I don't know. It just seems a little strange. I mean, you know, you'd have mentions here and there, but they weren't really actively pursuing the Samantha storyline. So,
just a few things I wanted to mention here. One detail that always kind of creeps me out is the way the character of Ed Truelove kind of enters the frame like gut first. You know, I just find something about the way that's shot really unsettling.
Oh, yeah.
Kim Darby as Kathy Lee Tenke gives an effective performance, I think. I mean, the only other thing I've ever seen her in is she appears opposite John Wayne in True Grit, and she's like a teenage girl or something, I think. I assume she's had like a full career.
Oh, let's talk about Darby for a minute. She was in an early episode of Star Trek, the original series. She did some great stuff, genre TV. She was in a classic horror TV movie called Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. You know, absolutely fantastic. I mean, it was recently remade into a feature film. Brilliant performance, brilliant film. She was in a TV movie with William Shatner called The People. And this was a film about this woman who goes to teach, you know, sort of like this Amish community. And she finds out that they're all actually aliens. I think that one of the inspirations for The Kindred comes from that TV movie. So I think that that was a really inspired bit of casting, and there's always like this sort of knowing undertone to when people like that are cast. And there's always some sort of reference to the work that they were, you know, known for previously in their career. You know, it's a brilliant performance. I think she plays it extremely well, but also it's very much a nod to her history and her previous work. To me, this episode is like so good. It's almost kind of hard to talk about because everything is working. I mean, you know, the machine is firing on all cylinders. I think this is, you know, and it was so shocking because there's such a sense of chaos and confusion previously to this two-parter that you kind of felt like the show was kind of slipping away from itself. It really lost sight of what it wanted to do. And here it's just like, it's just so bang on. It's just like, you know, unbelievably on the money, on the mark. that it's almost shocking, you know, in the context of the episodes that surround it. I mean, I'll tell you something. When I watched these two episodes, I was just like a mess. I was just like, particularly with Closure, it's just like, I was just, it shattered me. It just, like, emotionally, I was just undone.
Well, I had like a similar reaction, but it's only on the last two occasions I saw Closure. And I don't want to be too sappy or anything, but the only thing I can really put it down to is that the last two times I've seen Closure is since my daughter was born. And I don't know, something's just changed. And
oh, sure. No, absolutely. Of course. It gives you an entirely different context.
Definitely. Just finally, I thought it's probably worth briefly discussing Tina Mulder, Rebecca Toulon. I'm trying to remember just now. Is this the first time we see her in L.A.?
Yeah, I believe it is, yeah.
So, I don't know. She's always felt kind of underserved as a character to me, you know. She does get some good material at times, but maybe they could have used her more or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Very good actress. Always gave tremendous performances with very, you know, almost sort of like emotional porn kind of scenes that she was put in, but she was always very good and she always understated them. I mean, one of my favorite performances by that actress was on Demons, you know, very difficult, very challenging scene to play, and was just absolutely stunning. And I, you know, David was also very good on that episode as well. Yeah, always very good. Really not given a lot to do here. You know, it's one of these things where a good actor puts their mark on not only the scenes they perform, but the scenes around them. And I think that you kind of feel the power of her character and her performance, you know, throughout the two-parter. It reminds me of, you know, the classic example I always give is like, you know, Marlon Brando is only in Apocalypse Now for like, I don't know, less than 10 minutes. But the entire film is about him. And his performance, you know, sort of validates that. You know, you're this sense of anticipation of getting up the river, getting up the river, getting to Kurtz. And then, you know, when Marlon Brando, his charisma and his screen presence, you know, it pays off. And I think in this case, it's not that same kind of story at all, obviously. But, you know, you feel the loss of this character because, you know, the person playing that character was always so good.
I suppose another example would be, I think Anthony Hopkins is only in The Silence of the Lambs for 15 to 20 minutes, which you wouldn't think. If you were asked to say how much he was in, you'd probably put it a lot higher.
Yeah, same, exactly. That's a great analogy.
Okay, I guess we'll wrap up there. I think we've adequately conveyed that we, the two of us at least, are big appreciators of this episode.
Absolutely.
So Chris, I'll speak to you in a few episodes' time for a couple more season 7 outings. Tomorrow on the podcast, it's Closure, the episode that wraps up this two-parter, and that's followed by X-Cops. In the meantime, listeners, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast. You can find us on Facebook. If you type in X-Cast, you'll find our page and our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast Podcast Fan Group. But until next time, trust no one.